It's not far-fetched to believe that not only the New Testament writers understood this, but you have the early church fathers who are agreeing, saying, yeah, when a giant died, that's where the demon spirit came from. Paul tells the church, the believers have been transferred out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of the beloved Son. And that these two kingdoms are definitely at war, because Paul later in Ephesians tells us that we're not wrestling against other humans, not against the flesh, but we're against a host of armies of this kingdom of darkness. And that's what we're here to talk about today. We're pulling back the veil on the kingdoms, talking about where they come from, what is this mission? So we can answer this question when Jesus says, seek first the kingdom of God. How are we doing that? Because this kingdom is not of this world. It's of the spiritual nature. So we are here to talk about Christ, the gospel, and the war that we find ourselves in against the kingdom of darkness. And it is your host today, John Moffitt, pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and Doug Van Dorn, who is the pastor for 22 years, I got it right, in Boulder, Colorado, the Reformed Baptist Church of Boulder, Colorado, of Northern Colorado. Official name. Yeah. And to learn more about Doug and his writings, you can go to Douglas Van Dorn at or douglasvandorn.com. And we need to figure out how to get your old website back. Is it they're just charging you too much?
You don't like my new website?
Doug Van Dorn's is easier to say, but
I know. Yeah, if you got $1,000, and they might give it to you.
Is that what they're charging you?
It was more than ridiculous. That. Yeah, they wanted more than that. Yeah.
Just probably because of the traffic you were getting.
Probably.
All right. Thanks for listening. We're picking up where we left off last week. Really, this is a very long conversation. So my encouragement, we go back to episode 1, where we introduce the idea of Genesis chapter 6. But we're going to pick up where we left off last week. We were talking about the giant wars, the holy wars. And we were explaining why Nephilim, the fall, it doesn't mean the fallen ones. It literally means giant. And Doug, in that conversation, we started talking about the practices of the giants, where it says in like Deuteronomy, do not practice the or worship the gods or practice the activities of these clans. And one of them that was mentioned there was necromancy, talking to the dead or practicing witchcraft. Explain to us is this where it comes from? Is necromancy and witchcraft come from the giants? Like, how do we understand these? Because they are end up practiced by Israel. They end up picking them up and using them, unfortunately. But talk to us a little bit more. What does the text have to say to us about the concept of the giants and witchcraft?
Well, yeah, I mean, you just said it. They were the inhabitants of the land, and Israel was not to practice what those inhabitants were doing. And it mentions all this kind of stuff. And for our purposes, we're talking about kind of the crossing over aspect. They were doing all kinds of terrible things with regard to law and with regard to family and all, you know, other more, I guess, normal things. But in terms of supernatural, they were really involved in some evil practices. I'll give you an example from a discovery that I made, my one Indiana Jones moment. I write about this a little bit in this book, and I'm writing a full another book with an archaeologist about it, Judd Burton. And it's in the region of Bashan, ancient Bashan, which is where King Og was from. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a 4,000 plus year old structure, actually 5,000 plus year old structure in the middle of the wilderness, about 10 miles east of the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, and in the northern part of Israel. And they call it the Wheel of the Giants. And one day I was out looking on Google Earth at this Wheel of the Giants, and my eye caught something that was only a tenth of a mile away. So just a few hundred feet away from it, just to the north of it. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like a giant serpent mound. And the reason I was thinking about this was because Bashan actually means the place of the serpent. And so for whatever reason, I had several things circulating in my mind as my eyes fell on this. And I called up actually another Reformed Baptist friend of mine. I said, man, you got to go to Google Earth right now and tell me if I'm crazy. And so he went to the place. And I said, just go north of the wheel. He goes, this is a serpent mound. And I said, I'm not crazy. He goes, no. So subsequent investigation is we discover that ancient peoples in the era of King Og actually put a bunch of structures on top of this mound feature, and they didn't put it anywhere below it. It's only on the mound. And so I got to visit that last year with the guy who's done the most archaeological work on this place. And he starts talking about how the peoples that were there were actually doing acts of necromancy and trying to bring, you know, rituals for the dead, whether it be for their dead ancestors or maybe to bring up the dead back up or whatever. And there was this strange interconnection between this serpent mound and then the wheel that was just to the south of it. By the way, it's actually literally due south of Mount Hermon, which is where the peak of Mount Hermon, not just Mount Hermon itself, which is where Enoch says, and all the traditions say that the Watchers ended up coming down in the days of Jared. So there's all this funky alignment, astronomical alignments going on with both the mound and the wheel and with Mount Hermon and in the place where the giants were. And they're practicing the occult of the dead on top of this. And it's like, that's crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So that's a living example of what the people were doing when Israel came into the land. Now, wow. I made a comment last time that people couldn't possibly imagine the actual connections going on with the necromancy, the sorcery, the crossing over with these giants until they realize the New Testament connection that we have to giants. So last time we kind of ended just with David and Goliath. There's more to that story in the Old Testament, actually, that takes us all the way to the end of the Bible, at least the historical books in the book of Esther. But today we want to focus on the New Testament and how this war is not finished. It actually continues. Now, the first thing, if I say that to somebody, they'll be like, what are you talking about? There's no giants in the New Testament. And I'll say, you're right. You won't find giants in the New Testament. But you will find something else that you don't find hardly any of in the Old Testament. And it's especially prevalent in Jesus's ministry. And it's actually especially prevalent in Jesus' ministry in the north, where the Sea of Galilee is and the region of Bashan is. And that is all these demon possessions. Mm. And they're like, you mean demon possessions? What in the world does that possibly have to do with giants? So let me read just, I could read one or two quotes from the earliest church fathers on this. So to set it up, first of all, every single church father in the first 2.5 centuries, and basically every single one until the first 3.5 centuries, believed that the Genesis 6 story was supernatural, that the sons of God were heavenly beings.
Or and famous angels, ones that like even wrote creeds.
What's that?
And famous ones.
Yeah, and it's 100% of them. This is not a 50-50 or a 70-30. It's literally every single one that we know.
That's right.
Took that view. They also then talked about the offspring, the Nephilim, and this is some examples of what they say. So here's Justin Martyr, probably my favorite church father.
Yeah.
As a great
apologist. So I meant a famous one.
I love him, man. This is what he says. For the truth shall be spoken, since of old these evil demons, affecting apparitions of themselves, both defiled women and corrupted boys, and showed such fearful sights to men, that those who did not use their reason in judging the actions that were done were struck with terror, and being carried away by fear, and not knowing what these were, not knowing that these were demons, they called them gods, and gave each of them which each one name that the demon chose. And then you keep reading these fathers and you start to see that they're actually saying that the demons are the offspring of the sons of God. When a demon dies, this was the idea, when a giant dies and loses its body, it becomes a demon. They literally say this. I have a whole appendix in the 10th anniversary edition dedicated to this point.
Yeah, they literally read all of the quotes.
When he's got them all in there. All just quotes. When a giant dies, its spirit becomes the evil spirits of the New Testament. And so that becomes the explanation for the origin of evil spirits. And it's like, well, why would that be? And the answer is because just think about it, who their parents are. You have one parent from earth and one that's from heaven. So it's like, well, where does it belong naturally? It belongs somewhere in the middle, it belongs somewhere in the air. And so this becomes the explanation that they don't, when they die, they don't go to heaven or hell. They just haunt. They haunt the air, unless God curses them and casts them into the pit, where they would be. And that right. gets you into some extra biblical literature, like Enoch and Jubilees, especially, that talk about mm-hmm. how in the days of the flood, God actually bound 9/10 of the demons into hell. But there's an evil spirit that's arguing with God and saying, well, you can't throw them all there because humanity needs a little bit of trouble while they're alive. And so God like says, all right, I'll leave 1/10 of them, which is a really interesting number because it's the number of the tithe. I will leave 1/10 of them there to basically test and tempt men. And so that's the kind of the pre-flood explanation. But then the post-flood is when like King Og or Goliath or whoever dies, then they actually become demons. Really strange idea. If you think about like the Amalekite episode that we talked about last time, where Moses has mm-hmm. to hold his arms up, my mind starts immediately picturing, you're taking out all these physical giant beings, but you're not getting rid of the problem when you kill them, because now all of a sudden you have all these demons that are coming along. There's actually a verse in Deuteronomy that talks about these new gods, and it calls them demons that have come along lately. And you're like, well, yeah, what does that mean?
Deuteronomy 32.
Deuteronomy 32, 17. Demons that have come along lately.
Now, lately, that was not
the same word for an evil spirit, but it is the same word for like a territorial spirit.
Right.
And my mind immediately goes to this idea that they came along lately because you killed them. And now they're haunting you in this area.
And what's helpful to help people here, I think the early church fathers probably were using the book of Enoch, but also the New Testament writers, because both Jude and Peter one quotes it, but then references it, and particularly in the area of the giants, and particularly of the area of the demons. So it's not far-fetched to believe that not only the New Testament writers understood this, but you have the early church fathers who are agreeing, saying, yeah, when a giant died, that's where the demon spirit came from.
Mm-hmm. So very important for people to understand that demons are not fallen angels. They're the children of fallen angels.
Yeah, can I jump in there too?
And they lose their body.
There's nowhere. That's right. There's nowhere in the text, because people always say demons are fallen angels. I'm like, where?
Yeah, that's
where do you go to get that?
That's not the view. I think I mentioned last time that the word nephal for fallen one could be the origin of that idea.
Probably.
As if they fell from heaven or something. That's not what the text says. You just have to go.
Or in Revelation, when he sweeps the angels, a third
of them out of the sky. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not talking about demons. It's talking about the fellow brothers with Satan.
Right.
So,
right. And you don't ever hear of angels embodying people.
And that's exactly what I was going to say is that, when you come to the New Testament, what are they doing? Well, one of the things they're doing is, the main thing they're doing is they're, possessing, a host, a human host. Well, why would they want to do that? Well, think about it logically. They've lost their body and they want to be embodied because that's what they were, but now they can't be embodied. And so somehow they've figured out a way that they can live vicarious embodiment through possession. Angels don't do that. Angels don't need to do that. Angels couldn't do that because they have their own bodies.
That's right.
They're physical in some sense. You know, when Abraham meets them, he washes their feet. They have a meal together. They talk face to face. Jacob wrestles with one.
Wrestles with one, yeah.
They're physical. Demons are not physical. They've lost their physicality. They were destroyed. They died. And then they just haunt. And they look for more people and, I suppose, animals and stuff like that with the pigs, you know, in Legion.
That is such a weird one, right? With the pigs.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to think about that. And then they run off into the water.
Well, there's a whole bunch of weird stuff. I preached on that several months ago. And the whole thing is just kind of a funny story. Pigs were actually, they had to have been raised by Gentiles, because a Jew would never raise a pig because it's an unclean.
That's true. That's right, the law.
And they were actually using the pigs in these sacrificial rituals for the dead. The exact same thing that I just told you about with with the serpent mound. So the Gentiles were doing that. And so the whole thing is completely wild when you think about it, that this one dude has this legion of demons inside of him, and it begs, don't kill us now. Let us go into the pigs. Well, all right, that's pretty weird, thinking about the ritual of the pig itself. Maybe they're thinking that they can survive it, or if they, at least if they're sacrificed or something later on. I mean, I don't know what they're thinking, but the whole story turns on him, because then the pigs go mad and they run down the hill and they drown themselves in the Sea of Galilee. And it's a picture of what happened prior to the flood, where all these giants were destroyed the first time around. So no, it's like they got their comeuppance and they tried to get out of it and didn't work out very well for them.
I'm going to remind you what I did the first time.
Exactly. And this is the power of Jesus. And then at the end of that story, all the people are like, I don't want to have anything to do with this guy walking around here doing this kind of stuff. Go away from us.
Well, then they were terrified, because he's sitting there in his right mind.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody's like, oh, this guy was the one breaking chains before.
Yeah.
What it is interesting.
Notice that he's hanging out in the tombs. That's more of what's going on. Like the tombs, the crossing over, the dead. This is just part and parcel of what this demonic stuff is all about in the New Testament.
Right. Well, even like practicing necromancy, talking to the dead. What's interesting about that is we can get into this, but I did an interview with Doreen Virtue, one of the first episodes when we relaunched Kingdom Unveils, and this is what Doreen did for years, even wrote books on how to talk to the dead, which then she will straight up tell you, I never talked to any dead at all. I was talking to demons, but she was never terrified of them. She wasn't afraid of them, because obviously she's being used by them. But I asked her, you know, point blank, was this just like kind of a joke, or was this a magic trick? She's like, oh no, I was gaining information that I had no access to. And it's, I always think it's funny. I've never seen the Bible tell us not to do something that isn't like a legit warning. Like, don't talk to the dead. Well, not because you can, but don't talk to the dead because you can. Don't worship other gods.
That's the point, right? That a lot of people think, well, that's just a silly warning because you can't do it anyway. Because we all know that seances and all that kind of stuff is just hokey and there's nothing real to it. No, that's not why it's forbidden. It's forbidden because we are not permitted to cross over. And one of the main reasons is because you can't trust what's on the other side.
No.
These entities do not have your best interest in mind, and they have very powerful ways of fooling you and thinking, making you think that they do. And right. God says, don't do it for that reason. And that reason alone, I put you here on this earth. I put them on the other side, and you're not to interact with one another. And that's basically what we've been trying to do with one another since he forbade it, right? I mean,
that's right.
They crossed over here before the flood. That's what Jude says. They left their proper domain and their authority. They came over here. We tried to do the reverse at Babel. We tried to go up to them and cross over. And so then God gave us to each other. And now we got the same thing going on with demons, and that they become like intercessors or guides to the other side or whatever. And not a good thing.
Well, a great example of a girl possessed by a demon. And what is she known for? Fortune telling, right? She can tell the future. Yeah, and she's making a lot of money doing it for these guys. And she's annoying Paul to the point where Paul's like, enough, be gone. And he casts the demon out. And then he goes to prison for it because he messed with the guy's way of making money.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's a total offhanded. It has nothing to do about demons. It's just kind of like this offhanded story. It's like, that happened. Luke's like, that happened. He's like, well, that's interesting. But the point of it being is like, as Paul is going throughout the New Testament and he's preaching the gospel, he's still engaging people who are being controlled by these spirits. And they have capacities. First of all, I mean, if we're just looking from narrative, strength,
Mm-hmm.
They can communicate.
Think about, we'll stop on the strength for a minute, because what were they in the former life? They were giants.
That's right.
They were incredibly, massively powerful.
Right. And we know that they are communicating with each other, because how else is this young girl telling these fortunes and these futures, right? So there's definitely, and when, well, like, this is just a theory. I have not done any research on this. Maybe you have, Doug, but in my mind, when necromancy is happening, you've got someone who's talking to a demon, and most likely they're using the network to figure out how they're going to communicate this stuff back so that you can keep them coming. Because what Doreen told me was she wouldn't ask for any other information than just tell me your first name. And so you're like, well, my name is Doug, and you wanted to talk to one of your dead relatives. And they would say, well, what's your dead relative's name? And then she would start telling information about the dead relative that there's no way Doreen would be able to know that. In my mind, I'm like, they're somehow using some kind of network. She said sometimes it wasn't always accurate. And I was like, they got the wrong guy. I don't know. I'm not trying to make light of this, because I'm telling you right now, this is resurfacing on massive levels in the United States right now.
Yeah, 100%.
And they're preying on people who have lost their children. This is who they're going after. And so all these necromancy, all these, mediums are talking to parents who want to know that their child's okay. And they're paying money, and they keep going back and back and back, and they're getting drawn in. And this is exactly what Paul says, is they appear of an angel of light, but they've got no intentions of doing what's good and healthy for you. They want to draw you in by being helpful and kind, and then they're going to cut you off at the knees, which is what he warns us against. So anyways, kind of went on a tangent there. But not only is it warned about in the Old Testament and practiced by Paul, Saul goes to the witch of Endor and calls up Samuel. And whether you want to say that's actual Samuel or a demon, I mean, my guess is that it was actually Samuel, because he curses Saul for practicing necromancy.
Yeah, there's nothing in that story, when you read the story objectively, that makes you think it's anything other than Samuel. The only reason why we can't accept that is because we're like, well, that's not possible.
Right.
Well, that's not a good argument. You need to figure out from the text what's possible and what's not possible. And there's nothing deceptive in what Samuel's doing there. He's rather irritated that he's been brought up. And you should have demons aren't very paradise, man. That's what demons are looking for, right?
That's right.
It's a very unique situation. We don't have any reason to believe that that's going to be allowed to happen. This is not a story, in other words, of do what Saul did and it will work for you too. This is a story of history. And the whole point of that history is you really shouldn't have done that, Saul, because tomorrow you're going to be dead.
You're going to die. Well, and the witch freaks out.
Yeah.
As if like, oh, this isn't who I normally talk to.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what is it?
She's like, it's an Elohim.
It's an Elohim. Yep. That wasn't supposed to happen.
No, it wasn't. And that's what I think is interesting about the story. She does her thing, whatever it is that she's doing. All of a sudden, she's like, this is not normal. And then realizes who it is, because she understands that it's Samuel, and realizing, oh, the only person who would ask for Samuel would be Saul. And she realizes, you lied to me.
Yeah.
It's a very fascinating story. All right. So going to the New Testament, Doug, it's interesting. Jesus calls them a very interesting name. Calls them unclean spirits.
Right.
Is that by accident?
No, I think it's directly related to what they are by their nature. If you go back and you look at Genesis chapter 1 and you see what God creates, everything according to its kind, And then you find that phraseology again in the flood story several times, when the animals are coming onto the ark, according to their kind. And those are the only places that we read that phrase in the entire Bible, but it appears multiple times in both of those stories. So why? There's a series of laws in Leviticus 19 that talk about how you're not supposed to mix clothing with two different kinds of fabric. You're not supposed to mix your field with two different kinds of seed, all this kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And that actually happens to be, believe it or not, the very central core of all of the Pentateuch, those verses, according to reading in the literary structure. It's really wild. And the imagery there is really of kind of giving birth, actually.
Mm-hmm.
that's for a totally different kind of a show, but very interesting. But the point I'm bringing up here is that God does not want the mixing of kinds. That's viewed as unclean in the law. So now you go back to Genesis 6 and you ask yourself a question. If an angel comes and does something with a woman and they produce a giant, what kind of a creature is it? It's not according to its kind. It's according to something that shouldn't have been. This is not God's creation. It's something that's an abomination in terms of what he directly created. This is meddling. This is tampering. And the holiness code way of talking about that would be unclean. And so if a demon then is the disembodied spirit of one of these creatures, then it makes all the sense in the world to call them unclean spirits.
Right. And not an angel.
Definitely not an angel.
But yeah, so when he casts them out, you know, talking about casting out these spirits, these unclean spirits, eventually they receive the name demon. That's what they're referred to as demons. And to me, that all makes sense because you still have them disrupting and messing with the Messiah, messing with the people of God, and attacking them, which is still a part of this war, this seed war, to which you get to the New Testament, and we're still being warned about this. And at this point, Paul and Peter, but specifically Paul, he's like, look, there's an entire economy within the spirit realm that is opposing. It's in rebellion. And that's who, as we are trying to do, so we're advancing the gospel. We're doing so by means of the church. We're proclaiming the gospel. And we're also, in our suffering, we're showing kindness and forgiveness and grace. What does Peter say? Be ready to give an answer to anyone of the hope that lies within you. Why are we doing that? It's because of the way in which we're conducting ourselves. He literally says, because you are not indulging in the flesh as the world is, in these sensualities, and people are going to see that your life is different, and it gives you the opportunity to be a light and salt. But there to prevent you from this, or to tempt you or pull you back in to the prison that you were once in, which is the domain of darkness, this is who you're warring against. And this is when he names all of these different entities. So from rulers that are these fallen angels, fallen gods, down to their children, there's this whole economy of rulers and principalities of the air, and they're all in there, and they all have different functions. And so it's simple to say that when you're looking at something and you're saying, wow, this person is speaking a language that they clearly don't know, they have superhuman strength, or they have some kind of clear, I mean, because Jesus was also healing people from ailments. These demons were coming in and just causing them to be blind or causing them to be lame, which is, I don't know if there's any kind of like a reason why they were doing that. I don't know if anybody's ever done studies on that, but God delivers them from it. And all of this is related to the attacks that we're going to face is what Paul is talking about. So here's the connection. They were fighting the war in the beginning. They were being consumed in Genesis chapter 6 and following. And then when they're getting into the land, these giants, who are the demigods created by the angels, the gods, whatever you want to say, are preventing them from getting into the land, which is fulfilled to fulfill the prophecy of the Messiah coming. And then once they die, what do? Now they haunt the people who are the believers in the land, who the Messiah then comes and delivers them. And once again, why is it so important that Jesus delivers the demons from these people? Because it's demonstrating what he's done all the way back in Genesis 6. He's constantly delivering them and showing victory over them. All right, I'll make this one connection. I'll throw it to you, Doug. What is 1 Peter? I'm preaching on this on Sunday, so I'm a little like nerd and geeked up about it. What is 1 Peter 3:18-22 talk about? He goes down into the prison in the spirits and he declares victory. I mean, it's this constant cosmic holy war that starts in Genesis 3 and is still happening in 1 Peter 3 when he's raising from the grave. He's like, look, you all tried to stop this, and I'm here to proclaim victory that I won. And Peter uses that as an encouragement for those of us who are still suffering in the church. Like, hey, we're still suffering against not only the flesh and a broken world, but being persecuted for our faith. He points to the holy war and the victory that Christ gained at the resurrection, saying, I know that you're feeling this, but in the end, I still win. I've already won. We're finishing up the war here. We're rescuing the rest of those who have been chosen. So just remember, you're not going to be defeated.
In my first go around with this, in the first edition of the Giant Book, I took a different view that I got from the Word Biblical Commentary.
Yeah.
I think of Michael Ramsey or somebody like that wrote that. And then I modified that view in the second. So as we read it, for Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, to put to death in the flesh, being put to death in the flesh, but being made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. So we'll stop there for a minute. The first go around, because I couldn't understand some a key word here, which is the spirits. I took the view that this is basically a proclamation after the resurrection, that wherever he would go, he would proclaim to the basically the evil spirits, the demons, through the gospel, that he was victorious. But then I came to realize and understood that the word spirits is actually used more broadly than just of demons in extra testamental literature, so that it's actually can sometimes refer to the watchers themselves, the sons of God.
Yeah. Yep.
And so my modified view is that I don't have a problem saying that whenever the gospel goes forward, and starting with Jesus at his, you know, at his resurrection, that he's somehow proclaiming his victory over evil spirits, unclean spirits. But I think that this is actually talking more specifically about Christ's famous descent into hell that we talk about in the Apostles' Creed. And that this is coming straight out of Peter, who Peter's wrote 2 Peter too, and Jude is very similar to 2 Peter. And it's very clearly focusing in on this time period before the flood. What does the spirits in prison refer to in 2 Peter? Well, it's talking about when the watchers were locked up in Tartarus, and Tartarus is a prison. And so it seems to me that the descent into hell, and that could be a whole other program if you want, John.
Oh, we're totally going to do one on that for sure.
But
totally doing one.
The short of it is that Jesus did not go to hell to be punished, but he went there to proclaim victory. The reason why is because everybody went to hell. Hell is the Greek Hades, and it's the translation of Sheol. People have deep, profound misconceptions of what Hades actually is. It was the place of the dead, and it was the place where the damned went. It was a place where the righteous dead went. They didn't go to the same part of it. And then it was also the place where the evil first generation watchers were locked up. And that's basically what's being proclaimed here, is that Jesus is proclaiming his victory over them. But now, having said that, it's also important to know that according to some of the Old Testament texts, the Proverbs, Isaiah talks about this, the Rephaim that we talked about last time, who are one of these giant tribes, are said to reside in this place too, almost like overlords or something like that, ruling. Like, this is not the place you want to go because they're down there. Dante kind of talks about this in his Inferno, where they're down there waiting as these giant guards to, you know, you can't get away from them. And because they're also called spirits, it seems to me to make sense that they would also be included in that proclamation that, look, I was just put to death. You thought that you were going to get me? You know, that sort of thing. I'm just laughing. Yeah. Just wait until I leave this place and burst your bonds. And then he rises from the dead and he proves that he's victorious. Now the gospel comes after that, starting with him. And every time we proclaim his death and resurrection, we're making that proclamation that Jesus has judged them and they don't have the power that they once had.
No. They still have power,
yeah, but not like they used to. They haven't been sentenced to the final judgment where they're thrown into Gehenna, but they have been judged judicially so that their power to inflict, well, their power to possess, their power to defile us, their power, you know, it's been greatly curbed, and God can take us out of the evil kingdom mm-hmm. and bring us into the kingdom of light. That's what this is unveiling, to use a podcast term.
Huh. What about that? man, I can't find the verse. I just saw it the other day. You were talking about every time the gospel goes forward, it mentions this. And I want to say, it's in 1st or 2nd Corinthians, where it talks about when we proclaim the gospel, the rulers and authorities in heavenly places hear what we preach through the church. I need to find it. I know it's available, but I'll find it here at the end. Anyways, this has been, but going back to the descent into hell, Sam Remenhan wrote a book on this that was extremely helpful. And this is another part of our Bibles where we assume that there's synonyms for hell. They're all these just different words, but it's the same place. Everything is just this burning lake of fire. And that is not how the Old Testament or the New Testament understand what's in the earth. There's sections of the earth such as paradise, as Jesus tells the. Well, I'm not going to get into the podcast. We'll save that. But the way that the Old Testament describes the grave and where the place of the dead go in the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's a reason why it says in Hebrews that Jesus descended and then ascended and brought many sons to glory. Yeah. It's a beautiful concept. And I love it even in Ephesians. Man, okay, we'll end with this. I'll let you comment on this. I listen to this. Let's just go there real quick. Go to Ephesians chapter 4. This is when he's about to tell the church the supernatural work that's going to happen in their churches. And listen how he prepares them for how the church functions. So, this is Ephesians chapter 4. He's like, look, you're all of one body, one baptism. We're here to talk about this oneness that we have in Christ. And then it says in verse 7, but grace was given to each one of us according to the measures of Christ's gifts. Therefore, it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and he gave gifts to men. In saying he ascended, what does it mean? But that he did also descend into the lower regions, the earth. He who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. This is in parentheses in the ESV.
Yeah.
And then he's like, okay, now back to what I was saying.
Yeah.
And he's like, now this, and he's talking about this victory lap. Like, we're winning. I descended. Why? Because there was something that's happening there. I think Peter gives us a fuller light into that. And then he comes back and says, okay, it's this spirit is now doing this work in the church. And so he's going in between the victory, the war, because there's a already not yet aspect to what we're reading. The already is Christ won the victory. The not yet is the war's not over, right? So how does the church function? Well, when the church functions properly, it builds itself up in love. In what? The proclamation, the teaching of Christ, until we're all what? Unified in the knowledge of Christ. And then he goes into chapter 6. Well, what can stop the unification of the church? What can stop us growing in the knowledge of Christ? What can stop us growing in love? Well, the war can. And so he's like, you've got to arm yourself in the church. Otherwise, these entities are going to come and stop the advancement of the gospel, which is why we started Genesis chapter 3 and chapter 6, because I am convinced, and I know Doug is, from Genesis 6 to Ephesians 6, it's all connected. It's all about the war. And it's all about the victory of Christ. All right, my sermon's over.
No, good. I mean, I don't have any more really to add. This is why you want to tell the story of the supernatural, because all of a sudden you can start making sense of so many more things than you ever dreamed possible, just by understanding that there really is a seed war that works itself out in the Old Testament, first with the sons of God and then with their offspring. That was a physical war, that took place over centuries and centuries and centuries of Israel doing what they're supposed to do, and they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And then it coming to ultimately to Jesus, who's the only one that is ultimately going to cast them all away. And then knowing that the story doesn't end with him, but it really just begins with him, because now we as his body on earth are now going throughout the rest of the world, not just into the land of Canaan and into Jerusalem, but to the rest of the world, proclaiming this message of freedom and release from these entities that have held people in bondage for a millennium.
Amen. Well, and even that's the, and what's interesting is that what we're using, like in the Old Testament, they were using the sword to cleanse out the land and prepare the land so that the Messiah could come. And the weapons of our warfare are no longer swords. We're no longer cleaning out the lands. What are we doing now? The weapons of our warfare are words.
It's the sword we're using. Spirit.
That's right. It's all, it's to me, it's like it, when you understand it this way, I'm probably giving too much credit to C.S. Lewis here, but it makes the Bible feel like you're reading this almost a child's novel, but in full graphic form. I mean, it's pretty graphic in there. But it, all this war and this violence, it makes a whole lot more sense. Like, oh, the violence makes way more sense, because you're talking about a really evil force that's trying to stop Israel. And it's not just bad people. It's like these are unclean entities that are, you know, basically, if you want to use the whole Star Wars illustration, this is the Clone Wars. I mean, these are clones that are created as literal fighting machines designed to take us out. And yeah, we need to get rid of them. We absolutely need to get rid of them, which is why, you know, there's an ethical issue even in our world today, is we're thinking about people trying to create, you know, clones or trying to clone humans, and how unethical that feels, because it's kind of like if you're creating this biological being, where's their soul? Where's their spirit? Do they have one? And that's a whole nother conversation. So anyway, stick with us. The next episode we want to jump into is we're going to take a break from all the crazies and all the stuff that we've done and deal with some of the kickback that we often hear, some of the rejections, anywhere from giants all the way to gods, and saying that we are promoting things like another form of polytheism or henism. And we're going to help kind of walk you through why this is still monotheism. This is still falls within the creeds and the confessions, and we haven't gone outside the bounds. And then some areas of tradition that we need to challenge: the idea of where the demons come from, fallen angels, the fall, all of these type of things.
Let me put that a little bit different way, John, because it's not challenging the tradition. It's actually the tradition has challenged the tradition. The tradition was changed.
That's right.
Okay, I can't say that strongly enough. The tradition was changed. And all we're trying to do is go back to what the scripture actually says and all the tradition agreed with.
That's right. Yeah, you really see during the time of Augustine is when you see the massive shift just from in writing.
Yeah, and the reformers were just reading him, and they weren't reading the earlier fathers. They really weren't even aware of this, what we're talking about in terms of the history of it. So I think it's important to hear that.
And they lost the Book of Enoch, which was really, which helped. I mean, I think you can come to all these conclusions without Enoch, obviously, but it helps shed some light. And wasn't recovered till the 1800s. So they were long gone before then.
Yep.
All right. Well, that was a longer episode, a fun one. We've heard some of your feedback, and we've heard a lot of it for a long time. So we want to start working through it. So stay with us. Next episode will be kind of working through some of the common objections, specifically on the nature of God, Elohim, and the demons. We'll try our best to try and answer some of those. But thanks for listening. Go check out Doug's stuff at douglasvandorn.com. And if you want to learn more about the demons and the giants, you can get his book on Amazon. And that's all we have for you. So we'll see you next week.